Even David, you know, in David and Goliath, even David can, you know, use some, I don't know, special medication and become Goliath, you know, and become big and beefed up, or I don't know, go to the gym. When somebody asks me for permission about to do something, my first question is, what do you think? Right? Like, I just bring it back to them. And they say what they think. And they actually have, you know, pretty good judgment on that. And then my second question
that's
goes,
that's a good one.
So what's stopping you? Right.
That's a very good. That's very good. Hello, I'm Radek.
I'm Michael.
And this is the podcast.
A sounding board for interesting ideas and insights. We discuss books we read, I want to share with you.
As well as technology and productivity, which is what we do by day working on our app, Nozbe.
Or whatever else comes to our minds.
Speaking of books, I just recalled a book I read last year. Do you recall David versus Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell?
Yeah, I really liked Gladwell's books, and this one is also very good.
Yeah, Gladwell's books are pretty fun reads. He's a good writer.
Just recently, I haven't told you this, but just recently, because I made some decisions, and one of these decisions, in the moment that I made it, I was sure of it, but then later I started questioning it and, you know, analyzing it, everything. But I was sure of it when I was doing making the decision. Mm-hmm. So I reread Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, the beginning of the Blink, mm-hmm. Where he explains the gut reactions and why the gut reactions are very cool. So yeah, I mean, Malcolm Gladwell has really some really good insight there.
Yeah, he does, and I just recall David Goliath, and I connected it to the things we do right now.
Mm-hmm.
I just made this connection and realized something. This neat way of phrasing what we do at Nozbe. That's kind of that's very relevant, right? The way to make decisions, to you know, how we choose things, how we develop our applications, you know, all these decisions, they really neatly fit this frame put forth by David versus Goliath.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have a very small team, and what we do is we try to conquer the world of productivity, and we do it from a country which is not the US, mm-hmm. and we don't have any funding, and still we can pull it off with a small team and actually reach, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands actually users. So
yeah. So you're seeing the direction where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
In this metaphor, we're the David. We are kind of an underdog. Nozbe has been out there on the market for like, you know, close to 10 years,
yeah.
Which seems ridiculous to me. But it's a small company, and our competitors are much bigger.
Much bigger, much better funded. And yeah, and still, I'm just, you know, just today I had an interview with one of our Nozbe business customers. Mm-hmm. And he just told me that, you know, he checked all of our competitors and he chose Nozbe because it's just better. So like when I hear that, I'm like, yeah.
That's good to hear. But see what I mean? Like, even though we talked about this many times, we don't tend to think of our competitors as our competitors because it doesn't really matter that much. We're not directly competing with each other. It's not a zero-sum game.
Yep.
We're much more competing. We're competing with non-consumption primarily, with people just using email, not doing, or post-its, or not doing anything special at all. So we don't tend to think of what Wunderlist or Todoist or Basecamp or Asana are doing, but it's not like we never think of it as in, you know, for us to win they have to lose, but still we do want to win, right? We don't want to be, you know, crushed and disappear just because those guys are bigger and they have more coders, more designers, more VC money. And they can do more things such that they somehow obsolete Nozbe.
And it's also, you know, the thing that it's not like we don't have it because we can't get it. I mean, I was, you know, I was approached by VCs several times it's also the decision of who you want to be, you know. Even David, you know, in David and Goliath, even David can, you know, use some, I don't know, special medication and become Goliath, you know, and become big and beefed up, or I don't know, go to the gym. I don't know. But I mean, it's who you want to be, or how you want to act, how you want to, you know, how you want to, how you want to act. And, and it's, I think it's also a choice that we don't want to be a Goliath. We want to be a David.
Yeah, but either way, like, even though it was a decision, it does put us in some ways more difficult position, right?
Because okay, yeah, that's true.
We are in the less advantaged position compared with our competitors, and so I've been thinking about David and Goliath, right? We're the David, and the thing is, like in this story, in this metaphor, David didn't win because he turned out to be stronger than Goliath. He won because he played by different rules. He didn't care what Goliath was up to. He just did his own thing, and you know, he didn't went, you know, face to face, head to head, and beat him up, right? Like that he would never win this way.
I don't know if we have to refer the David and Goliath story to everyone, because I hope people, you know it, but in case they don't, Goliath is the big guy with an armor and weapons and everything, and he's about to fight David, who's
just a regular guy.
Watching the sheep, actually.
Yeah.
Right? So, and he's without armor, without any weapons. Only what he has is a stone. Mm-hmm. And he just throws the stone exactly with a device, like he throws the stone directly in David's chin, right? Skull, exactly. I mean, just, you know, just perfectly at the speed of actually a bullet, right. And the guy dies instantly. So the idea is that David is a small guy, no armor, and there is the big guy with armor, and actually, and the big guy with the armor, he was expecting somebody big with an armor. Mm-hmm. So it was because he was taught that this is how you're supposed to fight. Right. And David did a different approach and caught Goliath by surprise, as you said, because he just chose a different route to actually fight with him.
I don't think we're very good at retelling those stories. That was not good, Michael. But the point you made is just that. Like I hate like warfare metaphors. But that's the thing. You cannot go against a bigger enemy fighting the way a bigger enemy expects you to fight. The only way in which you can win, and a way in which you have a reasonable chance of winning, is if you fight asymmetrically. If you do something completely different, and use, you know, disadvantages are benefits in disguise. You know, take what you have and you know, take what seems like a disadvantage and use what you do have against the Goliath, right?
Yeah, but what happens is that it requires you to think differently and to, as you said, to it's like this situation when something bad happens to you, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, in the first moment, you think, I'm screwed. I mean, this is the worst thing ever. But then later, you see that, you know, there's this thing of seeing glass half full and glass half empty. So you can see actually that this you know, drawback can be an advantage in disguise. Mm-hmm. And this is the same thing when you are small, when you're like small and you're not as well funded, you can cry that you don't have the money, or you can do something else and take it to the advantage to make it better.
That's right. So another metaphor that that kind of fits here would be guerrilla warfare. Mm-hmm. So you know, again, like it's irregular warfare, right? It's asymmetric warfare. Quoting from Wikipedia, like you'd use like military tactics such as ambushes, sabotage, raids, petty warfare, hit and run tactics, mobility, right? So again, not to turn it into a big warfare metaphor, but the point is, as a small group, you are fast, you are mobile, you can move anywhere. A large army is large, so it has a lot of inertia. It has to like move in this huge group, and it can't be not seen. So if you have like as a tiny army, then you don't just go against this huge army. You do something they do not expect. So that's kind of what we should be doing, right? We can't out Microsoft Microsoft. We can't, you know, out Basecamp Basecamp. We have to do our own thing. We have to kind of develop asymmetrically. We have to do this guerrilla development, I guess.
Just the other day, I was in discussions of hiring a person, and there were just discussions. But anyway, it was interesting because he told me how much he wanted to earn, and it was very, very, it was very high, the salary that he requested. And I was like, no, it's a little bit out of our budget, this salary, like right here. I'm sorry. And he was like, yeah, but do you know how much is the salary in this city? And I'm like, I really don't care, because I don't have to hire from this city. I can hire from anywhere. So, so really, I can find somebody more talented than you for less money. So from a different city, you know, so this is what I'm going to do. So, you know, it's, you know, it's cruel, but on the other hand, this is actually what my advantage. We don't have an office, so I'm not tied to this, you know, zip code that I have to hire people within this, you know, area, because and it might be expensive area or cheap area or whatever, you know, but I can hire from anywhere I want. And actually, one of the missions of our company is to hire talented people from wherever they are, just to find talented people. And I don't want to, and why this guy was saying, you know, the salaries of this, you know, kind of person here in the city, because he's competing me with salaries given by big corporations. Mm-hmm. And I cannot fight with big corporations. I mean, whenever there is a guy from big corporation coming to me, usually I lose because he wants a lot more money than I can give him, because he's being, you know, the big companies can have more money to spend. Right. And they just offer better financial deals. They don't offer better jobs. I don't think so. But actually, these people wouldn't contact me before if it was the case. But they actually want a good job, but with the corporate salary. So, you know, something has to give.
Right. So there will be a first example in like how we compete asymmetrically. Like it does, you know, like. It sucks for him, right? But here's the thing: a big corporation can offer you a lot of money, or you know, pay you a lot of tax for being a terrible place in which to work. And for us to compete with it, like, we can't out corporations.
Not really.
We don't have so much budget to, like, you know, pay people twice as or three times as much. Like, we can't do that. But what we can do is, first of all, like, The disadvantages, our budgets are not as big as for corporations. We don't have a fancy office. Our advantages are, we don't care. We can hire from anywhere. And an office, you know, one corporation has a fancier office than another corporation. We don't care. We have no office. And instead of this, we can hopefully offer you a much better satisfying job with a lot of these other things that you can't get. That's asymmetric. We don't try to go, you know, head to head against the corporation, because we could not possibly win. We do a very different thing they can't offer.
Yeah, and the same guy was complaining that that his company is moving to open office very soon, so
right.
Good luck.
good luck.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Right. So that's one thing. And like what we discussed last week about how we communicate and collaborate, right? In a big company with an office, you can just have all the meetings you want. Now, first of all, we don't have enough people and enough time to do these many meetings. And second of all, we don't have a physical space, a physical office in which to do those meetings in person. That's a disadvantage. and to try to compete against that would set us up to fail, because we can't possibly do more of that. You know, we can't outmeet corporations.
No.
So what we do, like, we use asynchronous tools. We collaborate asynchronously, not more synchronously, more asynchronously, right? We don't do more meetings. No, we have fewer meetings and collaborate more effectively, and not just more. That's asymmetric.
When I was writing this book that we can, we're right now offering with our back to work promo in Nosby, the No Office Apps book about our pyramid of communication, when I was writing it, I really realized how big of a problem companies with an office have, because they are set up to talk instead of work asynchronously, instead mm-hmm. of work through text. I mean, it dawned on me that actually working with text, you know, comments, things like that, it's just better, because also you have the history of what's happening. You have the history how you got to some decisions. And when you just have lots of meetings, you talk, you don't write down, and then later, it's really hard to bring people on the same page. So like, I didn't realize it, you know, until I started writing this, that, you know, that I think for the traditional office to actually, you know, use our way of working, they would have to really force themselves to really use these asynchronous methods from mm-hmm. ground up, because they're not, you know, fit for that.
That's exactly right. And you, like, one way of looking at it is, well, you are forced to use these lesser tools because you don't have an office, because you can't do this. Another way of looking at it is, if you do have a physical space, you're naturally led to those communication methods, which are not necessarily better. And indeed, not having that forced us to look another way, but instead of trying, you know, to do those same things without an office, in which case that would be worse off for everybody, we just were forced to, you know, were led to try something else, which we found was actually kind of better. But it was also different. It was not us trying to do this, you know, more or as much as others. We instead we just did a very different route.
Yeah, and when I actually gave a speech to one of the big corporations in Poland about this, about how we work, I was really surprised that they wanted to hear more about it. They wanted to hear more about our asynchronous work, because they recognize the problem. They recognize the problem that their Microsoft Outlook package just forces them to create meetings, like, you know, and they wanted to learn more about this. So actually, our, you know, the big guys now want to use our methods. Also, they're not ready for them.
Exactly. So another example of this asymmetric guerrilla development would be how we ask for forgiveness, not permission. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, in a corporation, you can always have more structure, more checks and balances, more people to sign off on whatever it is that you're doing. We can't do that. If we try to do that, again, I think you're getting the point. We would set ourselves up to fail, because we can't do that. So instead, we do a very different thing. We ask for forgiveness and not permission. Prevent mistakes when possible, of course. You know, ask for guidance when it makes sense and when easy, of course. But trivial mistakes are also easy to fix. So if we can, like, completely, like, sidestep the whole problem, not have all of this bureaucracy, and just do something, that's better. That's an advantage that corporations can have, because they're so big, they require this hierarchy and rigid structure not to fall apart.
Yeah, I mean, when we make decisions, we try to make pretty small decisions, actually. We have also every now and then a big decision to make. But normally we don't. Normally our, you know, daily job consists of many small decisions. Mm-hmm. So if you change the decision, you know, quickly, no problem. You know, you'll change it. You do something differently, and then somebody else says, no, we shouldn't do that. Okay, then you can fix it. But very often, actually, when you just move faster and make the decision yourself, mm-hmm. you gain momentum, and you create momentum for your whole team, which in turns just spins the wheel faster, and you just move faster. that's why I really hate it when people make me the stopper. I mean, they make me a person that has to sign off on all of their decisions, you know, mm-hmm. because I'm the CEO. I don't want that. I would rather be informed of what they've just done instead of asking me, Michael, should I do that? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you should. I mean, you're the expert in this field, you know, just do it and let me know the results and mm-hmm. let me know why you wanted to do it. I trust your judgment, you know, I trust you don't want to sink the company. So just do your thing. If you're not sure, you can just ask me for a quick call or for a quick information, really, but try not to, you know, because I have things to work on. So, and when we have these checkpoints, like we have like this, you have Scrum meetings, I have daily, like weekly meetings with my teams. So we have these checkpoints where you can ask me a quick question, but usually I really prefer that people really ask for forgiveness later. They don't ask me for permission. They move fast, they create momentum, and they get things done.
Especially that it's not as if we did those big projects and then like half a year later someone was like, wait, why have you been working on that? It's like, exactly. No, like we, like again last week, level one of communication, we do something, we put it on GitHub, we put it on Nozbe, we put it wherever it is that we're working on, and like essentially every day as we make progress and just put stuff out there, people see it, and we usually don't expect feedback unless we ask for it. It's like, I did this. But if people are not okay with this, they're going to tell you because they can see it. So like, don't, you know, stop wasting everybody's time and just, you know, just do things, man.
Yeah, totally. And that's why I'm emphasizing this a lot. And also we are trying, when we are hiring people to our team, we are looking at this kind of people, you know, because, and especially in our non-office, no-office environment where people cannot be pushed to work. They have to have a drive to mm-hmm. work. And with this drive, we want to create this environment of just go mm-hmm. and just, you know, keep me updated, you know?
That's exactly what you said right there before. We cannot push people to work. Mm-hmm. Big corporations can because they have resources to have these managers and structure and hierarchy
exactly.
to make sure people are on track, do work, suggest what to do, etc. We can have it. We don't have the resources to do that. That's a disadvantage. An advantage? Okay, let's just use it and hire for people who don't need that, who can self-manage as much as possible, and then you can only have this very like thin, transparent layer of control that's not intrusive, that's more, you know, focused around feedback and like correcting mistakes rather than being there on the critical path of every single decision.
Exactly.
Or it's the same thing as we talked about when we discussed the book Originals, put the link in the show notes, about lean manufacturing, right? The person yeah. closest to the problem is generally most equipped to make a decision on that problem, right? Corporations will always have more resources to form committees, to deliberate on problems. We don't have these resources. So we just, again, sidestep the problem as much as we can. And to the extent practical, just let people closest to problems just fix them on the spot.
So I have a tip of how to enable people to ask for permission and forgiveness, mm-hmm. To ask for forgiveness, not permission. Mm-hmm. So my trick is this, and it's been working pretty well recently. When somebody asks me for permission about to do something, my first question is, "What do you think?" Right, like right. I just bring it back to them, and they say what they think, and they actually have, you know, pretty good judgment on that. And then my second question goes,
"That's a good one.
So what's stopping you?" Right.
That's very good. That's very good.
So when they hear these questions, you know, one after another, they're like, yeah, right. Actually nothing. So, and then they realize that next time they should, you know, ask these questions. And then really, if they think that there is a stopper, because for example, yeah, Michael, I would have to spend, you know, thousands from our company budget, then you better ask me for permission. But right. apart from that, just go.
Yeah, exactly. Another like broad point. Processes, right? Processes are like knives. They're useful, they're often necessary, but they're dangerous. you can really cut themselves with knives or processes, right? Like processes enable you to do things more efficiently or better, or make sure you have good quality, whatever. But they also cost time. They cost energy. They slow down the whole process. They make you less flexible. And the thing is, again, all these processes that we have, like, they're there for a reason and they're good, but they're only tools. So you have to be careful with them, because a corporation can always out-process you. They can always have like more of these processes, checklists, checks and balances, managers, hierarchies, you know, all these things which become just processes, these tools, but end up being bureaucracy. Big knife stabbing you in the back.
Yeah, I always had this problem with documentation. So, like, for example, there is this very famous talk by Seth Godin about lizard brain. Mm-hmm. And in this talk, Seth Godin explained that he went to his, you know, boss, show him the spec. The boss had to sign it off, you know, that he saw the spec, and then he was building something. Mm-hmm. Which sounds really reasonable, and the goal there is makes sense, so that the boss at the last you know stretch doesn't stall the project, right? Makes sense. But on the other hand, life is not black and white. If we design something today for Nosby, very rarely it actually goes into production in the same form that we just designed it, because mm-hmm. we're going to see it change during the design process, I mean the development process and testing process, mm-hmm. and usage patterns, and that's the thing. You can be stubborn to have the documentation at the last end, to have the process perfectly done, or you can have just none, which is also fun but not really, mm-hmm. but if you are halfway, so you have a good idea of what you want to do, you have pretty well outlined what you want to achieve, but still leave some room for improvement, then it just makes more sense. And then you have more flexibility. And of course, it gives ambiguity to the situation. But on the other hand, very often what I find is that, the people who actually implement what you designed can also use their own brains, how they mm-hmm. want to see this. So they can actually, because they have some room to breathe, they can actually, invent something even cooler while they're, developing it.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, it's not just about documentation being good or bad or a trade-off. It's also an example where it makes sense on surface to have as much documentation as possible, because you've designed something, it's all like, it's decided, like we can see before the real hard work starts, all the pieces, how they connect together. That's good, right? But it also makes you locked into place. And yes. Corporations... I say corporations, but I just mean like broadly, companies bigger than us, they can always out-document us because they can always have more people, more resources to do that kind of work. And so we could try to go after them in this route, but we'd probably lose because they always have more resources. What we can do is accept that documentation is a tool that can be very, very, very good when used in the right places and in the right amount, but by not overdoing it, we get something they don't have: flexibility. We can change things on the fly. We can experiment. We have more breathing room, right? We are much more comfortable changing things as we see reality not match up with our expectations during design, or when it turns out as we use it or as our users use it that it's not quite what we thought it was. When you have like everything outlined and you live and swear by the rule of not in documentation, not in development, then again you have to go through this like whole process, you have to redo the whole thing. But when you treat it as, hey, let's sketch this out, let's make sure we know what we're doing, and we have a good idea, not a perfect idea, but a good idea, then put it into development and then iterate as you go. We can do that.
Yeah, and it's also like, for example, when I look at our people in our team, we also hire versatile people, people who are doing just more than one thing. So I remember, you know, vividly when I was starting the company, I hired a designer who was a pretty good friend of mine. You know, it's a typical thing. You hire like friends, close friends that you have.
Yeah.
And he was a very good designer, but he had no clue about HTML, CSS, like all the technologies that are behind it. He was just drawing very nicely. Mm-hmm. And it's good in a company where they have like a bunch of these designers, and then they have a bunch of like front end people who do this thing, and then they have a bunch of other developers, and like they have a bunch of people. But if I have a small team, I cannot afford just to have one person who just does one thing, because I just can't. And I remember I was complaining, you know, on one of the social networks, and you know, there are no designers who know CSS. And to my complaint, somebody responded, and that somebody is our chief design officer right now. So it's the thing, you know, we cannot outnumber, you know, with designers, with front end people and whatever. That's why we hire more versatile people, and that's why we cannot document as much, because we want at some point to that our code or our implementation becomes part of the documentation, actually.
Oh yeah, so that's exactly it.
So we have to just move faster here. And again, this might be our disadvantage or our advantage, you know. But this is how it is, and I think it enables us again to move faster from the design phase to implementation phase.
That's a perfect observation. Specialists versus generalists, right? There's a very, very good reason to be a specialist, to have your narrow field and build your knowledge as deep as possible in that field. It makes a lot of sense, right? But it's also a disadvantage because you're blind to everything you don't know. So again, if you're a corporation, you better hire as many specialists as you can, because you can afford to have many, many people, and you know, with still like broad set of experiences. On the other hand, like this blessing in disguise. I'm just not a specialist kind of person. That's not how my brain is wired. I don't get excited as much about the most like narrow fields. I'm a generalist at heart, and this can be a disadvantage in a certain environment. But in a small company, that's perfect. And actually, not just in a small company, but let's leave that for another discussion. But here's an advantage we can have. You know, hire generalists, and then those people might not be able to do everything, you know, those big guys have. But on the other hand, as a generalist, you can do more things as one person, and also you have a broader perspective. You can connect, you can see how things happening, say, in design and in development connect, right? It's very helpful to have designers that might be designers but understand development, and developers understand design, because then they're not disconnected, and you don't need these silos between those teams where you have to like create this super specific documentation as a bridge between those teams, because generalists can see like both sides, and they can work with one another with much less overhead.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe you know, for us it's easier because we're both generalists, you know, so we know many things. But on the other hand, each generalist also has some niches and things like that. But still, you know, being a generalist, as you say, gives us this broader view, you know. Mm-hmm. And I when I think about it, you know, the I want to have really very good developers, very good, you know, programmers in my company, but I also want them to be able to try new things. That's why we have the TJF, for example, to make sure that they're not stuck in this one thing that they know, right?
Exactly.
Because this is I think this is not you know, also I think it contributes better to people's happiness, actually, to be able to learn more things from new you know, different ways.
Yeah, and to be clear, this distinction means a different thing for different people, right? It's not as if all of our programmers are also like deeply involved or interested in design. That's not the point. But
no.
we don't have, you know, a front-end HTML programmers and JavaScript programmers and people who only do database programming. Like we don't have that, right? Like people still have their niches and like specializations for sure, but they're relatively broad and they overlap to some extent, which is very good. And as you say, like even if you're only like interested in programming, you can still like there's a lot you can do to broaden your horizons and your abilities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just like you did learning Swift and trolling Objective-C. So
yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. that's my role.
Yeah.
Another thing I've been thinking about is kind of work ethic. You know, how you approach work. Again, very related to all the things we've been talking about. So a lot of like people, I feel like most people have this sense that you need to be on top of everything. You need to be in the loop and give as much feedback as possible. Share your knowledge and like you know stay in touch with like everything that's happening. And that's good, I guess. But again, a larger organization can always out feedback, out be on top of everything you. And what we can do is this asymmetric route for us is to focus. You know what I do a lot of time is I just disconnect from all the noise, from Slack, from Nozbe, from everything that's happening for like half the day. I start with the most important work, like in this flow state, in deep work, and only focus on that. And only at the end of the day do I connect to give feedback, review stuff happening around me, etc. And a lot of times I know I could say something, but I just don't because I don't have time to do it. And you could think of it as a disadvantage, but that's also an advantage, right? This situation is kind of forcing you to take this different route, which has very different advantages. You can have this culture where people expect people to be busy with their work, super focused on only that most of the time, which has tremendous efficiency benefits.
No, I mean, I just remember. A few days ago when I drafted the No Office Apps book that before I did that, I listened, you know, we had this the discussion on the podcast about it, about our pyramid of communication. Later, I re-listened our episode 17th and 18th of the podcast, which we will link to here in the show notes, and very good episodes, really. We did a good job there. You know, it was one of our first episodes, but very good. So I listened to them. And then, like on next day, on Tuesday morning, I think I finished one of the episodes. I reread again my essay on nooffice.org, and then I just shut down everything. I took my iPad and started writing, mm-hmm. And I had a kind of draft I written, you know, a few months earlier, but I decided to just I reread the draft. Also on Monday. So I had like all the information from the draft and everything, but I just had this idea that I want to just write it differently. I want to write the book a little bit differently and then later merge the drafts a little bit more. So like I managed to, you know, close down everything, took my iPad, sit down on a couch, and I wrote 10,000 words. Like wow. Just boom. And it was just amazing. But because I was conditioned, because I had, you know, I listened to all these things, I read all these things before, I was ready, and I didn't. And on in this morning, I just removed all my distractions and just didn't want to listen to anything else. And of course, later I had to pitch in because there were some other things, and we were preparing the promotion anyway. Mm-hmm. So I had to get back to work to like traditional work, like my, you know, other work, right? So I had to get back, but then I did it for like 2 hours and got back to writing, and then also had like another, you know, 2 hour stretch of writing. And this is something that you wouldn't have in an open office because they wouldn't let you. And this is something that we really care about. And this is something that really makes a difference because suddenly you're so focused, you're really creating fantastic thing, and it's not, you know, it's, and it's only because, you know, you're creating this environment where you can do that.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, David versus Goliath. You know, we're small. We can't win just by trying to make ourselves look bigger than the big guys. So the way to win is to be smarter than them, more efficient than them, more human than them. You know, not just try to do things they do, because that's no way to win. Do things they can't do or don't do. Do things they don't expect. Or, you know, there are things we take for granted now, like how we talked about, you know, working remotely, or how, you know, personally we listen to audiobooks, and people reject that. And we take that for granted. And this is kind of a personal advantage, right? Like we just do a different thing, not the same thing, because that's no way to win.
Yeah, what you said here was very smart. Like the thing is that because people tend to very often outright reject things, mm-hmm. because of their firm beliefs, and they're not open to a change, to a different approach, we can just beat the other guys. You know, we can actually, you know, we see that something new, and we can just try it. You know, try it for a second, try it for an hour, try it for a day. And then we can, you know, make up our mind if it's really bad or if it's really good. And people are, like, very people are stubborn and are not really open to this. And they're not open to change. And this is, again, our advantage. Because, you know, it's been always done like this. Yeah, but does it mean it has to be for eternity like this?